This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts. At least 60 worshippers were injured, some of them critically, Sunday, when a grandstand seating area collapsed in a crowded synagogue in a Jewish settlement in the occupied West Bank, according to an Israeli ambulance service. The incident occurred in the settlement of Givat Ze'ev, north of Jerusalem. A spokesperson for the ambulance service said about 10 people sustained serious injuries. A police spokesperson said 650 worshippers were in the synagogue at the time for the start of the Jewish holiday, Shavuot. The Israeli military said an attack on a militant tunnel system in Gaza Sunday had caused civilian houses to collapse, causing unintended civilian casualties. Aircraft struck at a tunnel system used by the Islamist militant group Hamas under a road in Gaza City, the military said in a statement. The military said it aims to avoid civilian casualties, quote, but Hamas bears responsibility for intentionally locating its military infrastructure under civilian houses, thus exposing civilians to danger, end quote. Qatar's foreign minister received a call Sunday from U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, the Qatari foreign ministry said. A ministry statement said the two discussed developments in Gaza, including the recent Israeli attacks on worshippers on Al-Aqsa Mosque and the attack on the besieged Gaza Strip, end quote. U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres told the U.N. Security Council Sunday that hostilities in Israel and Gaza were, quote, utterly appalling, end quote, and called for an immediate end to fighting. Opening the 15-member council's first public meeting on the conflict, Guterres said the United Nations is, quote, actively engaging all sides toward an immediate ceasefire and called on them to allow mediation efforts to intensify and succeed. This is VOA News. At least 6 people have died in torrential rain and winds as virus hit India. Braces for a powerful cyclone, officials said Sunday, with tens of thousands being evacuated from their homes. India's first major tropical storm this season is moving northwards in parallel with the country's western coast, bringing heavy rains, thunderstorms, and strong winds to several states, the meteorological department said. The Weather Bureau added it is expected to make land in coastal Gujarat as early as Monday night. Bodies of COVID-19 victims have been found dumped in some Indian rivers, a state government letter seen by Reuters said in the first official acknowledgement of the alarming practice. India reported a similar rise in daily COVID-19 cases. India reported a smaller rise in daily COVID-19 cases for the third straight day Sunday, but the number of deaths in 24 hours was higher than 4,000. Taking the country's death toll to 270,000. The world's largest vaccine-producing nation has fully vaccinated just over 2.9% of its 1.35 billion population as of Sunday, according to data from the government's CoWIN portal. A top Indian virologist has resigned from a forum of scientific advisors set up by the government to detect variants of the coronavirus, he told Reuters Sunday, weeks after questioning the authorities' handling of the pandemic. Shahid Jamil, chair of the scientific advisory group of the forum, declined to give a reason for his resignation. Britain is confident that existing vaccines will provide protection from a more transmissible Indian virus variant now spreading across the country. Health Secretary Matt Hancock tells Sky News the government has a high degree of confidence vaccines will stand up to the variant as England, Scotland, and Wales prepare to unlock parts of their economy Monday. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Boris Johnson has warned the variant could be a serious disruption to progress. He said the next stage of reopening the economy would take place as planned on Monday, but warned the variant might delay plans to lift all restrictions June 21st. Fighters of a local militia opposed to Myanmar's junta have pulled back from the northwestern town of Mindat after days of assault by combat troops backed by artillery, a member of the group said Sunday. The United States and Britain called on the army to avoid civilian casualties, and a shadow national unity government formed by loyalists of Myanmar's detained elected leader Aung San Suu Kyi appealed for international help. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga.
So long as I am president and God gives me breath, the powers of this office will only be used to serve you, never to rule you. So help me God.
Malawi President Lazarus Chakwera says dictators are made by people who always idolize their leaders and warns Malawians against overpraising and overdepending on him.
This ruling gives at least a sense of relief to all Zimbabweans that indeed we still have men and women in the judiciary who can discharge their mandate in a professional manner.
The High Court of Zimbabwe nullifies the controversial reappointment of Chief Justice Luke Malaba.
What we have seen is that there has been an increase in severity of crashes because the roads have been empty due to confinement and lockdown, and people have taken that as an opportunity to actually speed, and they're taking this opportunity to drive faster, and therefore you're seeing more fatal crashes.
And UN agencies urge policymakers to lower speed limits in a bid to cut traffic deaths and injuries. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. Malawian President Lazarus Chakwera has warned Malawians against overpraising and overdepending on him, a tendency that he says can turn presidents into dictators. He was speaking Friday in the capital Lilongwe during a commemoration of the country's first president, the late Dr. Hastings Kamuzu Banda, who many say was a dictator during the 31 years of his administration. Lameka Masina reports from Blantyre.
President Lazarus Chakwera, who became Malawi president after a rerun election last June, said it's sad that even during this democratic era, people want a president to respond to every little thing while also praising the president as they would a god. Without directly referring to former president Dr. Hastings Kamuzu Banda, Chakwera said dictators are made by people who always idolize their leaders.
Ufuna kutikali gonse, ayankeni president.
He says you want the president to respond to everything, including where to draw water, how to look after your children, your household, even what you want to wear. Dr. Banda, who led the Malawi Congress Party, or MCP, ruled Malawi from 1963 to 1994, when he lost the presidency to former president Bagini Muluzi of the current opposition United Democratic Front. During Banda's one-party system of government, many people were forced to go into exile, while others were killed by state agents. Banda died on November 25, 1997. President Chakwera, the current leader of the MCP, said his desire is to save all Malawians.
So long as I am president and God gives me breath, the powers of this office will only be used to serve you, never to rule you. So help me God.
He warned Malawians, however, that if they overdepend on him, they should not blame him if he becomes a dictator. During the ceremony, Chakwera praised Banda for the roads, hospitals, and educational initiatives he established during his administration. Political analysts are having a different reaction, though, to Chakwera's remarks. Sherif Kaisi, a political science lecturer at Blantyre International University, says he doesn't take Chakwera seriously because he said Chakwera does not walk his talk.
Because what he promised does not materialize. He said, I'm going to trim down presidential powers. And one of such presidential powers which Malawians cried for to be trimmed from the president's office is the appointment of the Anti-Corruption Bureau director. Another issue, for example, like he said as well, to not to be the chancellor of the University of Malawi, but he became one. So he said something and now he's doing something else.
Another analyst, Vincent Kondowe, said after stepping into the political limelight in 2014, Chakwera should be given the benefit of doubt because he has scant political experience. Kondowe said some presidents before him also voiced their similar sentiments, but later acted in a contrary manner.
For me, I would like to believe that that was an innocent and very honest comment from him as head of state. However, I would like to exercise caution because we saw in 2002, 2003, when Mulunzi all of a sudden changed tune and wanted to extend his term of office from a maximum of 2 terms to an open-ended term. So politicians, normally, you can't trust them.
In his State of the Nation address Wednesday in Parliament, President Chakwera announced that his administration has put measures in place to reduce presidential powers, as he promised during his campaign. Lameck Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
The High Court of Zimbabwe has ruled that the controversial reappointment of Chief Justice Luke Malaba is null and void, setting up a potential conflict with the government. For VOA, Adegondo has more.
The High Court on Saturday overturned President Emmerson Mnangagwa's move to extend Chief Justice Luke Malaba's term as the country's top judge beyond his retirement age of 70. The judgment that Justices Happiest Joe, Edith Mshore and Helena Sharewa issued Saturday means that Malaba's term in office ended when he turned 70 on Saturday, which is his birthday. There were two separate agent cases that were consolidated because they dealt with similar issues. The first one was filed by Musa Kika, who heads the Zimbabwe Human Rights NGO Forum, a coalition of civil society organizations operating in Zimbabwe. The second was filed by the Young Lawyers Association of Zimbabwe, represented by Emma Drury. The applicants argued that the change was unlawful because it did not comply with the requirements of Section 328 of the Constitution, provision that specifies a special procedure for changing the Constitution. President Mnangagwa's ruling ZANU-PF party recently fast-tracked Constitutional Amendment No. 2 through Parliament. It allows the president to extend the term of office of senior judges on the Supreme Court and the Constitutional Court by 5 years beyond the retirement age of 70 if they obtain a health certification from a medical practitioner. It also gives the president greater control over the selection of vice presidents. Some political analysts and legal experts see the court's ruling as a surprising but positive development for constitutionalism. The ruling also states that incumbent senior court judges cannot benefit from a constitutional amendment extending their terms past the retirement age. Doug Coulthard is a human rights lawyer and he calls the ruling a victory for the rule of law.
What the High Court has done has simply declared what the position in the Constitution is, which is that an incumbent cannot benefit from any amendment which extends the time that a person may hold office. As such, Luke Malaba is no longer the Chief Justice and no longer a judge.
Some legal analysts and opposition politicians have criticized Malaba, who was appointed Chief Justice in 2017, for what they see as an attempt to rein in High Court judges by directing them to submit their judgments before delivering them. Coulthard expects the ruling on Malaba to be appealed in an effort to have it suspended.
The JSC have already indicated that they do intend to appeal. Our respectful view is that that's not the case. The suspension of a High Court order is in respect of executable orders, but where there's a declaratory order such as this one, it will still stand, notwithstanding the noting of an appeal.
Order says that pursuing an appeal will deepen the constitutional crisis the country already faces because of the constitutional amendments that have been made. Political analyst Thomas Stoller says the judgment provides a glimmer of hope in an environment in which the executive essentially controls most arms of the government.
So it's a victory for our constitution. It is a victory for our democracy. And it's a victory for all Zimbabweans. We know that parliament right now is in paralysis. It's been captured by the executive. So there is no parliament as it were in terms of exercising its oversight role. But this ruling gives at least a sense of relief to all Zimbabweans that indeed we still have men and women in the judiciary who can discharge their mandate in a professional manner.
Six of the Mnangagwa government say it is trying to undo the 2013 constitution and grab more power. However, earlier this month, government officials told VOA the constitutional amendments make it easier for the president to pick his vice presidents and ensure stability. Officials also said other countries allow heads of government to pick high court justices. In a statement last night, the Minister of Justice, Legal and Parliamentary Affairs indicated its intention to appeal the decision of the High Court, which analysts say risks pushing the country deeper into a constitutional crisis. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
Scientists in South Africa say COVID-19 variants, first detected in the United Kingdom and India, are now circulating in the country and are likely to increase the severity of a third wave of the pandemic. South Africa has been hardest hit on the continent by COVID-19 with 1.6 million confirmed cases and almost 55,000 deaths. Now, as winter sets in, infections are once again surging. Darren Taylor has more.
Medical scientists say the variants first found in the UK and India are unlikely to replace the one detected in South Africa late last year as the dominant strains. But they're still concerned, particularly about the three variants driving infections in India. Progressive Health Forum leader Dr. Aslam Dasu explains that scientists are trying to determine if these mutations increase transmission and virulence.
The upsurge in India indicates that is indeed the case. You would not be able to find that kind of transmission with the original founder virus, shall we put it that way. And with the force of infection, certainly of the kind we're seeing, tragically seeing in India, the emergence of more variants is inevitable.
Preliminary investigations by local scientists indicate that the imported variants, simply put, aren't as bad as South Africa's because they aren't as good at evading the immunity afforded by current vaccines. Nevertheless, say the medical minds, the fact that the mutations from the UK and India are now here can only add to the country's COVID-19 burden. South Africa's immunization drive is yet to begin in earnest, so Dasu urges citizens to maintain protective measures such as social distancing and wearing masks.
Look, we're not going to avoid a third wave. What we can do is determine the scale of that wave through the non-pharmaceutical interventions that we're all very familiar with. There's really nothing else that we have in our armory to protect people. We do know that you can reduce the peak of a wave and the extent of a wave just by utilizing those methods. But the third wave is upon us.
The problem is, according to Health Minister Zweli Mkhize, many South Africans have become complacent. This is putting pressure on the government to once again enforce a strict lockdown and to, for example, ban social gatherings. This wouldn't be necessary, says Dasu, if the state had a better vaccination strategy.
In short, it's woefully inadequate.
The government was forced to delay its immunization program a few months ago. This after it was determined that the AstraZeneca shot, of which it had bought 1 million, wasn't very effective in preventing mild to moderate COVID-19 in people with a variant dominant in South Africa. But, says Dasu, this excuse has only limited validity.
After that, it was clear, because it was very effective against severe illness, hospitalization and death, it should have been administered to as many South Africans as possible. Instead, we sold it off.
Like other countries, South Africa also has to pause its rollout of the Johnson & Johnson jab because of concerns it caused blood clots.
It was an unfortunate decision again. We lost a couple of weeks. That has now resumed. But our total vaccination is under 350,000. And this is of great concern, especially if we are trying to reach millions. We don't have the supply. And security of supply is a huge problem in any vaccination program, given the conditions of this particular virus. So we're in a very difficult situation going into the third wave. It would have been ideal in the past.
Dasu describes U.S. President Joe Biden's recent support of waiving intellectual property rights for COVID-19 vaccines as huge. The doctor believes it could result in a flow of vaccines to less affluent countries that need it most, such as South Africa, and potentially save hundreds of thousands of lives, if not more. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Conjoined girl twins who were separated at South Africa's Red Cross Children's Hospital are doing well. They were joined at the head, which is the rarest form of conjoined twinning. That's according to Professor Tony Figaji, who performed the operation. Reporter Vika Stark spoke to him.
Sigaji says Sipusetu and Amahle's mom is ecstatic with the results. 4 days after birth, the twins were moved from their home in the Eastern Cape province to Red Cross Children's Hospital in the Western Cape because it has a dedicated pediatric neurosurgery unit. Sigaji heads it and says it's the only one in sub-Saharan Africa. He explains their condition, craniopagus twinning.
Conjoined twins are when the fertilized egg doesn't separate and there's some physical connection, and they can be connected in different parts of the body. It may be the chest, the abdomen, the spine, the pelvis, or the head. And the head is the rarest of those forms. So in a country like South Africa, in our population, we'd see it maybe once every 15 to 20 years.
He says the team, which included anesthetists, plastic surgeons, and nurses, was well prepared, and the operation went better than expected.
Through the help of an anesthetist colleague of ours who was part of the team, he did a 3D printed mold, a model of the two skulls connected so we could plan it in advance. Both the anesthetic, because that's awkward, as well as the actual incisions that we were going to do. So the whole procedure with the anesthetic time and the surgery time probably took about 4 hours. But of course, there were a couple of weeks that we spent just planning it so that it would go very smoothly.
Sigaji says the babies have returned home.
As far as I know, they're doing well, as we anticipated, that apart from the wound healing, that they would go on to develop normally. We're not anticipating that they would run into any trouble.
Sigaji says they are due to see them in a couple of weeks for a checkup. This is Vicky Stark for Voice of America News in Cape Town.
Last week, the United States Department of State provided Congress with its annual Religious Freedom Report, which describes the state of religious freedoms in every nation. As usual, it found that government and non-government persecution of religious groups continues in many parts of the world, including Africa, while there has been some improvement in others. To get a sense of the state of affairs, both worldwide and on the continent itself, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Dan Nidell, the senior official for religious freedom at the U.S. Department of State. Mr. Nidell began by explaining why it is in America's interests to promote freedom of religion throughout the world.
We believe that religious freedom is a key feature in healthy societies. And when people are not able to organize their lives in accordance with their most central beliefs, the main themes that they care about in their lives, they're not going to be satisfied across the board. And it's more likely that you might disengage from society. You might turn to violence. So as part of our national security, we see it as really important that societies be healthy. And one of these features of health is respect for religious freedom.
Your office has just released its report on the overall state of religious freedoms in the world. In very broad strokes, what does it say?
Sure. So the overall state of religious freedom in the world is that there are a lot of challenges. More than 80% of people around the world live in countries with high or severe restrictions on the practice and exercise of religion. In Africa in particular, you have Eritrea. The government only recognizes 4 religious groups and harasses and jails those who practice non-sanctioned religions. The Orthodox Patriarch Antonios has been under house arrest since 2006, and members of all religious groups there were to varying degrees subjected to government abuses or restrictions, including Jehovah's Witnesses. We acknowledge that the government has released a number of religious prisoners over the past year, but we understand that many more remain imprisoned, and so we would strongly encourage the government to take steps to ensure that all religious prisoners are being released.
I know that historically, Nigeria has often been a hotspot for these sort of issues.
In Nigeria, what we've seen is continued lack of accountability for the military's killing of 350 people, mostly Shia Muslims, in Zaria in 2005. And the head of the Islamic movement of Nigeria, the largest Shia organization in the country, El Zaxe, and his wife remain imprisoned despite a 2016 court ruling that they be released. And we also see state-level authorities arresting and detaining people for blasphemy. So those are significant challenges. The head of the Humanist Association of Nigeria has been imprisoned without charges since April of 2020. And then also in Nigeria, we see violence between predominantly Muslim Fulani herdsmen and predominantly Christian farmers in the Middle Belt. And we're encouraging the government to address the root causes of that violence to ensure that it does not spin further out of control.
What about non-mainstream indigenous religions and spiritual practices?
Yes, unfortunately, it is the case in Africa, in Latin America, in East Asia, where you have large indigenous communities that members of majority communities and others often marginalize them. And other human rights issues related to these indigenous communities include property rights, access to education and health care. So this is certainly something that's on our radar. And what we try to do is we try to build and maintain relationships with indigenous communities to understand their concerns, their needs, to help empower them to articulate those needs with their governments.
What methods do you bring to bear, diplomatic, military, otherwise, to promote religious freedoms among groups or governments who would violate them?
Yeah, thank you for that question. What we try to do here in the International Religious Freedom Office is to work with partners, both internal, the government, but also external, foreign governments, civil society groups, religious communities themselves, to promote positive discourse. And so we're obviously using all of the tools in the diplomatic toolbox, both positive and punitive. If it involves holding an abuser accountable, that could involve sanction or other penalties, but also positives, embracing diversity in public ways and giving credit to governments that have taken creative steps to enhance tolerance and mutual respect within their societies. We work a lot with international partners as well. So the hope is that we create a critical mass of voices for mutual respect, for tolerance, for non-discrimination. And those voices can ultimately drown out those who would seek to discriminate or abuse or harass on the basis of religion.
That was Dan Nadell, the senior official for religious freedom at the U.S. Department of State, whose Office of Religious Freedom released its annual report on religious freedoms to Congress this past week. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. UN agencies are urging policymakers to lower speed limits in a bid to cut traffic deaths and injuries. A campaign to get people slowed down on the roads will be launched Monday at the start of the United Nations Global Road Safety Week. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Every year, more than 1.3 million people die in road traffic crashes and 50 million are injured. One person dies every 24 seconds because of a crash. The United Nations says car crash injuries are the eighth leading cause of death globally for all age groups. It is also the leading cause of death among children and young adults between the ages of 5 and 29. The focus of this year's Global Road Safety Week is to encourage policymakers to drop speed limits to 30 kilometers an hour in cities where cyclists and pedestrians interact closely with car traffic. The head of security and mobility at the World Health Organization, Nan Tran, says reducing the speed limit to 30 kilometers per hour in city streets will save lives.
Most people, most cyclists, pedestrians will survive if they're hit by a car traveling at 30 kilometers per hour or 20 miles per hour. Beyond that speed limit, the risk of death becomes much higher, and that's why we consider 30 kilometers per hour or 20 miles per hour a safe speed, because it means that most people will survive.
Slower speed, he says, has other benefits in making cities more livable. Tran notes cars are a big source of carbon dioxide emissions. He says slower speed will result in a significant drop in emissions, which will improve air quality. Since early last year, he says COVID-19 lockdowns and an increase in the number of people working from home has led to a marked decrease in the number of people driving. However, he adds, this has not resulted in fewer traffic deaths.
In fact, although we have observed a reduction in the amount of traffic and, in fact, in the amount of crashes, what we have seen is that there has been an increase in severity of crashes because the roads have been empty due to confinement and lockdown, and people have taken that as an opportunity to actually speed, and they're taking this opportunity to drive faster, and therefore you're seeing more fatal crashes.
The WHO reports Africa is the region with the highest number of road traffic fatalities in the world, with a rate of about 26 per 100,000 population. This against 10 fatalities per 100,000 in the Europe region. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This month, live from the Kigali Arena in Rwanda, the Basketball Africa League begins its inaugural season. Catch the action with VOA Africa. Monday's games tip off at 1200 UTC, 1900 UTC.
You are listening to the Voice of America in Washington, and this is Nightline Africa. And coming up in the second half of the program, sports. A commentary by Dr. James Joner, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. And in Nightline Africa sports, the fate of this year's African Athletics Championships is unclear after the Algerian government postponed the event without giving any new dates due to the global COVID-19 pandemic. This is the third delay to the event, which should have taken place in 2020 before being postponed by a year due to COVID-19. With the Olympics set to begin in Tokyo in July, the news will come as a blow to athletes across the continent who are hoping to use the championships in a final bid to achieve the qualifying standard for the Games. The sports global governing body, World Athletics, has set June 29th of 2021 as the deadline for reaching the qualifying mark to take part at the 2020 Olympics. The African Athletics Championships were last held in the Nigerian city of Asaba in 2018. In football, the Sierra Leone Football Association is seeking approval to finalize the details to host the postponed Africa Cup of Nations qualifier against Benin. Sierra Leone has opted not to go to the Court of Arbitration for Sport to appeal against CAF's decision not to award a win to the Leone Stars. Instead, the Sierra Leone Football Association has submitted some proposed dates for the crucial qualifier and will be submitting an inspection of the Siaka Stevens Stadium in Freetown to CAF in order to host the match. The Group L tie was supposed to have taken place in Freetown in March, but was called off when Benin refused to play, as they disputed five of their players returning positive COVID-19 tests that would have ruled them out of the crucial match. Now Sierra Leone has proposed to play the qualifier against Benin between June 12th, 13th and 14th, 2021 at the Siaka Stevens Stadium in Freetown. The proposed dates and venue are, however, subject to CAF approval. Still in football, Argentina's Hector Cooper has been appointed as the new coach of the DR Congo's men's football team. The 65-year-old has been given the task of leading the Leopards to the 2022 World Cup. DR Congo, who missed out on a place at next year's Africa Cup of Nations finals, are in a group with Madagascar, Benin and Tanzania for the second round of qualifying for the World Cup. This will be Cooper's second stint in charge of an African national team after his 3 years with Egypt, who he guided to the 2018 World Cup in Russia. And MC Alga came from a goal down to draw 1-1 against two-time African champions Wydad in the first leg of the CAF Champions League quarterfinals played in Algiers on Friday. Wydad hosts the return leg next weekend in Casablanca. On Saturday, Kaizer Chiefs of South Africa beat Tanzania champion Simba Sports Club 4-0 in Johannesburg. CR Belouizdad, making their first Champions League appearance since 2002, beat four-time champions Esperance 2-0. And in boxing, Anthony Joshua's promoter Ed Hearn has said that the long-awaited clash between the fighter and his British rival Tyson Fury will take place in Saudi Arabia on August 14th. A new stadium could be built for the occasion. The two are set to contest all four world heavyweight titles in a long-awaited bout set to take place in either Riyadh or Jeddah. Saudi authorities plan to allow international travelers, that's according to Han, although the fight has yet to be officially confirmed. Joshua has 24 wins and 1 defeat from 25 professional fights, but lost his 3 world titles in a shock defeat to Andy Ruiz Jr. in June 2009 before eventually regaining them in a rematch. Fury is unbeaten in 31 professional fights, but hasn't fought since beating Deontay Wilder in February of 2020. And that's about it for this edition of Netherlands Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict and in time of peace. Here is one man's point of view with Dr. James Joner, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Joner.
Good evening, Africa. Prior to the end of apartheid in 1994, the South African National Congress, ANC, represented to the global community the titanic struggle between the black and brown people of South Africa and the white minority government. The name of Nelson Mandela, the man who is revered throughout the world, was always linked to the ANC. And that is why, for decades throughout the length and breadth of the African continent, the name ANC was known to every tribe and grown up in the continent. This reverence for the ANC was justified when the first free and fair elections were held in 1994, and the ANC skeptical with massive majority, and Nelson Mandela became the first black president of South Africa. Mandela was the reconciler, and he embraced the white minority government despite his suffering in Northern Ireland as a prisoner. And to the people of South Africa, he demonstrated his commitment for unity by standing shoulder to shoulder with the African rugby team, a symbol of white minority government. For decades after decades, after the death of Mandela, the ANC began to lose support among the people of South Africa, including the black population. The main problem arose under the administration of Jacob Zuma, a man who was not embraced by the white business class or the white population. And they were able to sponsor and encourage Cyril Ramaphosa to challenge the regime of Jacob Zuma. The main issue that has been focused in South Africa then was the so-called state capture. That is massive corruption under Jacob Zuma's government. And there was a change. But the change to Cyril Ramaphosa did not prove so successful because the ANC convention was split and the big six executive was split 3-3. So the issue of widespread corruption and out-of-handed became the main political debate in South Africa. And recently, the consumer, who is now out of office, challenged the judiciary. He refused to appear before a committee to investigate corruption in the ANC. He argued that these had been cooked up by those who wanted to destroy him. And he said the verdict was already reached, so he would not appear and would be prepared to even go to prison for failure to appear before the committee. Then there have been challenges also within the ANC. The president, Syria and Apollonia could not compare the Secretary General of the ANC to stand by while there is some investigation. So it is all quite confusing within the ANC. Just recently, a secret paper surfaced, and it shows some of the grand dealings of the ANC are really concerned about the future of the ANC. They are really disturbed. And one member of the ANC executive committee said, why are you cherry-picking those who are guilty of corruption within the party? He said, we are all guilty. We have to think of him. And you, referring to the president, you, President Ramaphosa, you are also just as culpable as many of us. So when the president appeared before the committee, he said, I asked him the question. He did not impress many when he said he was not aware of what was being done by the former president. Recently, there were demonstrations in Johannesburg, and one of the leaders said something with great meaning. He said, and I'm quoting what he said, so the problem with the government of the ANC, that is, president, the ministers, is they are in office, but they're not in power, which means they may have the titles, but they can't make fundamental decisions that will affect the economic and social life of the people of South Africa. This has been the battle cry of Julius Malema, who had been expelled from the ANC and went on to form the Freedom Society Economic and Fight Party. In essence, then, unless the ANC tackles profoundly the large disparity between the minority in South Africa and the masses, its future will remain in doubt. Thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday here on Headline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect with music from the continent.
Wanna make love on the moon. Dancing to my tunes, easy to my way, stuck to my way. I wanna be a fortress, if wishes were horses, easy to my way, stuck to my way.
Be a billionaire,
yeah, 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 y
chizi kukupenda sita sizi sura yako mzuri mama.
Thank you.
kemewa tunawa kangwangwire ngabalala tebanawa atote unya tunawa osago mutima gukweka tigungere yo pepi ndadara hewala ndadara oike my love ndadara.
And that was our Sunday music spot on Netland Africa from the English service of the Voice of America. Netland Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Join us again on Saturday. Have a very good evening.